I need to die doing something good.
There's no heaven very often for these young kids growing up in South Central LA, where gang violence and lethal shootings can be an everyday part of their lives. Music has the power often to heal in the most unexpected ways, as you're going to hear from some of these stories coming up on tonight's The Sharon Hour. Just starting, that's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. What you just heard were the voices of two members of a choir in South Central LA, formed by a single man with a vision, with a little help from his friends.
Fernando Pullum is a name that you should know. This is an extraordinary man. He has single-handedly put together a public performing arts high school for Los Angeles, the very first. So I'm going to introduce Fernando to you right now.
Thank you so much. I do have to make a correction. It's not single-handedly, because it takes a large number of people to make this happen. This has happened through the Inner City Educational Foundation. So we're trying to not just bring music education to kids, we're actually trying to change lives and save lives. We're trying to take over South Central one household at a time, and that's through positivity. We teach free lessons on Saturdays. We're doing a food giveaway for the homeless. And now, with the help of the Lennon folks, a few other people, we're going to actually start a record company and allow these kids to write songs and sell those songs to earn scholarship money. I also would like to thank my friends, especially my really good friend, Jackson Brown, for taking the time to come out here. And also, I think it's a great treat for my students to be conducted by Mr. Ricky Miner, the conductor of American Idol and the Grammys. And also joining my students will be members of Fishbone. So thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you, Nam. Thank you, Yoko. And thank you, Quincy, for being here as well, for helping us.
Humans are a musical species. Music can move us to the heights and depths of emotion. It's often what we turn to in moments of joy or of despair.
How true that is. And there isn't always equal opportunity for incorporating it in its various forms into our lives. So what Fernando Pullum has done, with help from people like the Lennons, Jackson Brown, Quincy Jones, is truly laudatory. Leslie Dechter, who was one of the top directors of commercials when I was a commercials producer, certainly one of the most highly paid, gave up commercials to do lowly remunerative documentaries. And his documentary Growing Up features Fernando Pullum and his music school. Interesting how muse and music are very similar words, isn't it? Music's power over us human beings, and who knows, maybe other creatures, is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Well, actually, come to think of it, I do know that music affects other species, because when we lived upstate New York and became best friends and actually ultimately business partners with the farmer across the way, we started a dairy with them, doing milk in glass bottles. We learned that the cows would not milk if you changed the radio station from country to a different kind of music. So there you go. Music does affect the lives of other creatures than us. Speaking of upstate New York, music almost literally brought this next man, an orthopedic surgeon from that part of the world called Dr. Tony Sicoria, back from the dead.
It was a weekend in August 1994, and we were going to all meet at a place called Sleepy Hollow Lake. And I'm down on the ground floor running the barbecue. It was a beautiful day when I started, and my brother-in-law came out to give me a break. So I went to the payphone to call my mom just to check on her. And the payphone is connected to the building. And I dialed the number, and I let it ring 7 or 8 times, and she didn't pick up. So I went to hang up. And as I got the phone about a foot away from my face, I heard this loud crack, and this big flash came out of the phone and hit me in the face. The lightning had hit the building and exited through the phone, and I just happened to be in the way. So it hit me in the face and just sent me flying backwards. And as I was going backwards, something happened and suddenly I felt myself moving forwards. And I remembered standing there absolutely confused because I'd seen the lightning. I knew that I'd been hit and I knew I'd been sent flying backwards. But here I was standing there and I'm looking at the phone is just dangling. I'm still not making any sense out of it. And just at that moment, I see my mother-in-law, who's at the top of the stairs, and I'm at the bottom. She's screaming, and she's running down the stairs toward me. And anytime your mother-in-law is screaming and running toward you, you have to worry a little bit. But I had no idea what was going on. I noticed that as she got down close to me, she was looking at me like I wasn't there. At that moment, the only thought that came to me was, oh, shit, I'm dead. So I'm standing there looking at this body that's 10 feet away, and my mother-in-law's running over toward it, and she's screaming. And at that point, I'm calling out to them, and I can hear what they're saying. I can see them, but they can't hear or see me. And suddenly I have this realization that, my God, I'm thinking, and I'm having thoughts just like I normally would. And the realization came that whoever I am, I always am. And whatever's on the floor is nothing more than a shell. As I'm walking up the stairs, I notice that my legs are starting to dissolve. At that point, I was like, maybe this isn't funny anymore. And by the time I got to the top of the stairs, I had lost all form. And I remember looking down at myself thinking, you know, where did I go? It was just this hazy energy ball. I was completely separated and I was going someplace else. That's when things really started to get interesting. I was suddenly immersed in this bluish white light. And in that white light was truly the most amazing feeling. If you could imagine absolute love and peace. And it was a force that there was absolutely nothing else in it. And I felt like I was in a crystal clear stream and I could see the rays of light passing through it. But as I was thinking about this and looking at it, I could actually see the lines of the energy, which to me was amazing. You know, because of my science background, I thought, this is something I could measure. It's that strong. And what I was able to see was that this energy made up everything that exists and flowed through it. And I thought that whatever God is, this is it. And I was absolutely taken by how great it felt. And I thought, this is the best thing that could ever happen to somebody. And as I was going someplace, and I could feel the sensation of moving, I was going someplace. It had both speed and direction. And right about the time that I thought, this is the greatest thing that could ever happen, then suddenly it's like somebody snapped their fingers. I was back in the body and my little trip was over and it was not well received.
You are listening to The Strange Tale of Tony Sicoria here on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, dedicated tonight to the power of music. So what, you might say, has this orthopedic surgeon's return from the dead got to do with that? Well, listen on. We're picking up this story when he's having an out-of-body experience. He's looking down on his corporeal body lying on the ground. And he's fine with it. He's seen the other side and it looks pretty good.
There was a woman who was doing CPR and I wanted to just tell her to stop. But I must have still been unconscious because I remember just begging and pleading to whoever was on the other side to please not make me come back. Because this was really painful and it was pretty nice on the other side. Unfortunately, when you're back, you're back. They wanted me to go to the hospital and I thought, why bother? If you get struck by lightning, you're either alive or dead. So I refused. And I said, no, I'll be fine. I'll just go home and see my doctor when I get there. He ran a cardiogram and some tests and he said, well, everything looks like it's okay. And I saw my neurologist. Because I was having trouble thinking, I really felt like, if you've ever seen an old-style television, the tuners were always bad, and you always had to walk up and whack it on the side to make it work a little better. And I wished that somebody would do that to my head, because the circuits weren't quite working right. And that lasted for the better part of a week. And then the only thing left I had after that was just, I had trouble remembering people's names. Like, if I knew you and I knew who you were, you'd walk up and just start talking to me and I would know that I knew you, but there's no way in the world I could find your name. I know I see you all the time, but it just wasn't there. But it didn't have any effect on my ability to function normally. So that was the only residual, and that was gone in 10 days, 2 weeks after. It wasn't until several weeks later that I started to have this incredible desire to hear piano music. And I thought, oh, this is kind of weird, because I really wasn't a piano kind of a guy. I was a rocker. You know, that's what I like to hear. And I had taken some piano lessons when I was 7 for about a year, and I really wasn't interested. I went to the music store, and one of the first CDs I bought was Vladimir Ashkenazy playing Favorite Chopin. I was so taken with the CD, I played it back and forth. On the way to work, on the way home, I played it all the time. And then within a short period of time, it wasn't enough to just listen to the music. I wanted to be able to play it. I just ordered all of the sheet music and was determined to learn it.
But you couldn't read sheet music?
No, but there's magical thinking. Somehow it was just going to happen. At the time I was working full-time as an orthopedic surgeon, 12 to 14 hours, long days. In order to be able to keep up with this possession that I had all of a sudden, I got up at 4 in the morning and I would practice until 6:30 when I had to go to work. And then I would come back from work and I would sit there until literally I couldn't see the pages. And unfortunately, the time that I sacrificed was any time that I had with my wife. My obsession with the music certainly was my contributing 50% to our marriage breaking up. One night, I woke up out of a dead sleep at 3 in the morning with this dream. And in the dream, I was in a tuxedo at a concert hall, and I was playing a piece of music that was my own. And I'm in front of all these people, and I could draw a picture of the concert hall. If I ever see it, I'll really be freaked out. But I remembered the music. Memory of it was very clear. And what was more interesting about it was that every time I sat down to play, the music would start coming. So I would be trying to learn a piece of music, and this other music would just kind of muscle in and say, hey, I'm taking over. And I would sit there and I would try to write some more of it. And this went on for months. And eventually I was able to write, at least in a cursory way, what the music was. The best description of it I've heard has been from my daughter, Jordan. She said, that's your soul speaking. After the lightning, I really questioned why I was here. I struggled for the longest time with, okay, I've been spared. Obviously, there's something important that I was supposed to do. What is it? And I had thought to myself, the music is the thing that seemed to come back with me. I really was convinced that the music was the reason I was allowed to come back. Because the music was now my reason for being. The thing that doesn't make sense, when the music comes to me, it comes in sections, almost like it's like a computer downloads a file. The quantum physicists are entertaining the thought that our brains are actually just receivers of information. That they're not capable of doing all of the things that we expect our brain to do with the size that it is. but that it can receive huge amounts of information from another source. Where's the other source? Who's driving the other source? Who the hell knows? But start to play, and it takes you to a place that is away from all of the other stuff that you have to deal with in the course of a day.
There's something that awakened in him, something that changed. And maybe the most interesting thing about it is that he followed it, that he listened to it, and he did something about it. You know, he's engaged. He didn't walk away from it, and he wasn't afraid of it.
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only FM public radio station, KX935. My topic tonight is the power of music, and I'm going to play you now part of an NPR interview done with the late noted neurologist Oliver Sacks. After he had written his book Musicophilia, which told stories of people whose lives in one way or another revolved around music, whether they liked it or not.
Music occupies more areas of our brain than language does, a power that science can't yet fully explain.
What came first, the music or language?
Well, this has been argued for 2.5 centuries and probably continue to be argued. Darwin, who wrote quite a lot about music, felt very strongly that music came first and that song and dance were selected for courtship and that language followed.
Dr. Oliver Sacks is a neurologist and the author of many acclaimed books, including The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. His book, Awakenings, based on the work he did with catatonic patients back in the 60s, was made into a film starring Robert De Niro and Robin Williams playing the part of Sacks. His books are filled with the compelling stories of his patients, ordinary people coping with extraordinary neurological conditions. The book Musicophilia concentrates on his lifelong fascination with the connection between music and the human brain, and tells the stories of people who have almost magically unlocked a part of their musical mind. He says, for virtually all of us, music has great power. This propensity to music shows itself in infancy and probably goes back to the very beginnings of our species. One of the most fascinating cases that Sacks has studied is of a young man called Matt Giordano, who lives in the quiet suburbs of upstate New York. Matt has severe Tourette's syndrome. He's found that only one thing can help him control the involuntary movements or tics that Tourette's gives him, drumming. Matt's now 25, but the discovery that he had a natural ability for the drums came one day when he was 2 years old and heard the Moody Blues song, Singer in a Rock and Roll Band.
So that Moody Blues tune, that was the thing that really got you going, basically.
Yeah, well, I was two years old. And my parents, you know, just bought me a little toy drum just to keep, you know, a two-year-old occupied sometimes. And so they were listening to the Moody Blues on the record player. Huge Moody Blues fan, Moody Blues fans. So they were in the other room. And that song, I'm just a singer in a rock old band, came on. And all of a sudden, they notice I'm playing right along with the drums at 2 years old. So they kind of recognized I had a natural ability and gift at playing the drums.
The discovery of Matt's gift for drumming coincided with the first signs of his symptoms. This was back in the 1980s, when little was known about Tourette's, and no one really knew what was wrong with Matt, not least his parents.
Did it take you long to did you discover very early on that Matt...
We started noticing symptoms around when he was about 2 years old, but, you know, we didn't have a clue. We didn't have any idea why he was doing what he was doing. And it really wasn't until the tics got very severe. He would come home from school and spin in a circle on the floor for like 2 hours at a time. And he'd be crying, Mommy, Mommy, help me, help me. But if I tried to stop him, he would get angry at me because he needed to complete the tic. So that was when we brought him to the doctors and got him diagnosed.
What were the symptoms, besides, obviously, the ticking and the lack of coordination? There was also the anger, wasn't it?
Anything could set him into a rage, and it was very destructive. He broke windows and kicked holes in walls and broke our windshield in the car, and it was dangerous. It was dangerous for him. It was dangerous for our family members. But he's always been the sweet kid that he is now. You know, when he wasn't in a rage, just the gentlest, kindest, most wonderful person.
I mean, there was a period when he had to be sort of taken away from home, wasn't it? When he was sectioned, essentially, between the ages of about 8 and 12. I mean, was it that bad?
Yeah, it was that bad. He was either going to kill himself. I walked into the kitchen one day, and he had a knife pointed at his chest because he knew that he was violent against me, violent against his brother and sister, and... Like I said, he's a sweet, wonderful, gentle person. And to have that other part of him that he knew he was upsetting the family that much was destroying him.
Matt was in hospital for 4 years, and it was during this time that he found that his talent for drumming could help him control his Tourette's.
At school, he stopped being the weird kid with these tics, and he started becoming the drummer. Well, it was very good for his self-esteem.
The Tourette's doesn't so much go away as I think its energies get focused and channeled, right, and can even form a source of strength or energy. But it is the order of music, which is their great sort of bastion against chaos.
I mean, people are trying to work out whether neurologically music affects the brain and, in a way, the emotions
as well.
Absolutely,
absolutely. I don't. It's almost like my brain was a puzzle, all right? And some of the pieces were not in place. And all of a sudden, everything just kind of clicked in the two hemispheres of my brain. And I literally felt it like this. I was doing it, and all of a sudden, it went about this fast. And it kind of just clicked into place, and it literally went down my entire body. And when that happened, it was amazing.
Can you imagine your life without music?
I would go bonkers. I probably wouldn't be here, literally.
Sister Moon, shadows I would hide. Ark of the people asleep tonight. I'm all by myself in your silver light. I would gaze at your face the whole night through. I'd go out of my mind, but for you, I'd go out of my mind, but for you, I'd go out of my mind, but for you.
Tourette's afflicted Matt said he'd go out of his mind without music. The power of music is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's for me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5. And I'm using a variety of stories Oliver Sacks wrote about in his book Music Ophelia, about people whose lives would not have been tenable without music. Oliver Sacks, of course, was the renowned neurologist who also wrote the books The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Awakenings, which was made into a movie with Robin Williams and was based on Dr. Sacks's time exposed to a variety of neurological disorders when he worked at Beth Abraham Hospital in the Bronx.
This was the first place he witnessed the therapeutic power of music. When he arrived here, the corridors were lined with patients suffering from sleepy sickness, a disease which affected over 1 million people around the world in the 1920s. Sacks was now working with a ward full of survivors and famously gave them the drug L-DOPA, which brought them out of their catatonic states for a brief time. But he also discovered that even without the drug, there was one thing that could stir them.
These people, unable to take a step by themselves or utter a syllable, could dance, could sing, and could come completely alive for a while with music. That, for me, was the first, you know, it stunned me. It still stuns me to see it. It was an absolute revelation. They were liberated by music. They were freed by music.
Today, Beth Abraham is home to the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function and is a world leader in clinical music therapy. They work with the idea that when the brain processes the different elements of music, it can help awaken other areas of the brain that have been damaged. The Institute's motto is "Music has power," a bold statement that attracted the usually reclusive musician Moby to become a patron.
It seemed borderline absurd and miraculous. Like, I couldn't believe it, you know, that, like, people who can't speak are able to sing. and people who can't walk are able to dance. What they're doing at the Institute, the way they're almost rewiring the brain. You know, like if you have a damaged part of the brain through music therapy, but you're able to almost sort of like reroute around the damaged part. The way the brain can sort of very adaptively rewire itself, it really is miraculous.
Derek is a musical savant. He's 28 years old. He's been blind since birth and is severely autistic. In many ways, Derek functions like a four-year-old, and a great deal of his brain power is dedicated to hearing, processing, and creating music.
We've brought a little piece of music with us because we're making a film about music, and some people have got it and some people haven't got it. And you've got it, Derek.
Yes.
Here it comes.
I've brought some music to play to Derek because his mentor and music teacher has told me Derek will be able to play it back to me after hearing it only once, no matter how complex it is.
Do you want to try it without the CD?
Try it without the CD, right, please, Adam.
Yes.
Ready from the beginning? Here we go. Derek's turn.
Not only does Derek play the piece back note for note, but I'm amazed by his ability to improvise and play around with the melody.
Good. What would George do with it? Chords. What sort of style was that in, do you think?
George Shearing. Yeah. George Shearing.
That was George Shearing, of course, not Derek, one of my personal favourite pianists and one of my father's. My father had a similar talent to Derek's. He could also play anything by ear on the piano. We would come back from seeing a musical in town and he could play the entire score from memory, having only just heard it once. And I'm not exactly sure where that came from. He did play the piano well, but that's a special talent. The Power of Music is my topic tonight on The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on this Laguna's one and only FM listener-supported, member-supported public radio station, KX93.5. We're currently hearing the story of musical savant piano player Derek, who's severely autistic and blind.
Derek was born 3.5 months premature and weighed only 1 pound 5 ounces. The oxygen treatment he was given in hospital to keep him alive left him completely blind and with chronic learning difficulties. Even today, he has trouble counting to 10. But when Derek's parents discovered him playing the piano at the age of 2, they knew there was more going on inside his head than the doctors had ever imagined.
Suddenly they realised inside that brain where they thought not a lot was going on, actually Derek was mapping out his musical world completely perfectly. It was just extraordinary. When he was about 4, 4.5, his parents brought him to a school for the blind where I was teaching, and I was just teaching a girl called Kelly, and we were working away, and suddenly I was aware of being shoved in the back, and a tiny little Derek had run across and pushed me out of the way and just started to play. Just so motivated to make music even at that stage. Of course, he had the most tiny hands. He could only reach 5 notes, a fifth. And somehow he taught himself, "Don't cry for me, Argentina." But not just the tune, being Derek, he was playing scales and arpeggios, using his elbows and everything to get the notes in.
You remember that?
I do remember Derek. That, yes. I started to play Argentina.
How do you think you played it when you were little, Derek? Because you had tiny hands.
But although his brain can process music at lightning speed, it took Adam years to teach him the basic fingering skills.
Even today, Derek still doesn't really know his fingers from his thumbs, in a way. If you say, you know, which is your left thumb, he'd have difficulty with that. But the minute it touches a keyboard, it's a different matter. But the only way to show him was physically, for him to feel my hands and for me to physically guide him on the keyboard. And I thought it would take a month or two, but it actually took years and years, because in that respect, the learning difficulties were very apparent. When people see Derek play the piano and hear him, it's very hard for them to imagine how difficult a lot of everyday jobs are for Derek. His brain just isn't wired up to do a lot of the things that we find extremely easy, and yet something that most of us find impossible, he can do it automatically.
You have scanned his brain at some point, didn't you, with an ECG?
Yeah, we did one of those experiments where you put electrodes on the scalp, and we tried playing Derek little fragments of the Moonlight Sonata, some of which had errors in. And we discovered that Derek's brain, in a fraction of a second, before you could even consciously be aware of it, had registered what was right and what was wrong. His whole brain was lighting up with the music. And yet the verbal responses he gave were at chance level.
If you're blind, maybe your brain has space to accommodate something more.
Absolutely. I mean, there's this huge real estate of the visual cortex, and nothing stays empty. It'll be occupied by auditory stimuli, by tactile stimuli, and so the blind will reach out to sound, to touch, to smell, and those parts of the brain will develop instead.
Where are the bits of the brain which relate to our musical sense?
There's no one musical part of the brain, and in fact there's sort of a dozen different parts of the brain which respond to pitch, to rhythm, to timbre, to melodic contour. Although music is all, it's not just all, and it recruits many other parts of the brain. And in fact, you find that visual parts of the brain and motor parts of the brain, and also the parts of the brain concerned with anticipation and expectation, because one doesn't listen to music passively. One sort of decodes it as one listens, one sees where it's going, one has expectations.
Oliver Sacks has got me thinking, so I've decided to offer myself up as a guinea pig. I'm going to find out what happens to my brain when I listen to music. Neuroscientist Larry Parsons at Sheffield University has designed especially for me.
You'll be listening to different kinds of music that evoke specific emotional responses.
The team are using a functional MRI scanner, so they'll be able to pinpoint activity in my brain when I listen to the music. To make the test personal to me, I've been asked to select 3 different types of music. The first is something that makes me happy, then something that's annoying, angry music, and finally, a piece that I have a strong emotional connection to. Most of us take music for granted. We simply assume we'll be able to enjoy listening to the music we love. But imagine what life would be like if our brains couldn't decode or make sense of the music we hear. And what's more, what if we didn't understand why that was happening? Even if you don't like classical music, for instance, most of us can appreciate a beautiful piece of Chopin. But what if you're Anne Barker and it just sounds like an ugly noise?
No, I would never choose to listen to Chopin while in the car. It's not my idea of fun. That would be really irritating. I think I have a lot of accidents if I listen to Chopin.
Listen, I'm not incredibly knowledgeable when it comes to classical music, but I listen to something like that and I get goosebumps. Whatever you listen to and get goosebumps, whatever it happens to be, is something it would be horrible to have to live without, don't you think, listener? You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is the power of music. And we're currently hearing the story of someone who does not have an ear for it. Worse, it actually drives her a bit mad.
What does the piano do for you then? What is sort of...
I think it's the thumping of the keys that irritate me. I don't get any pleasure to listen to the piano. It's an irritating sound, particularly classical piano.
Anne has a special condition. Although her hearing is normal, she has the musical equivalent of colorblindness.
You can be deaf to music and to different aspects of music. You can be deaf to pitch. You can be deaf to rhythm. Or even if you hear pitch and rhythm normally, you may be deaf to melody, not just not catch melody, or deaf to harmony. And all of these things are called amusia.
OK, Anne, I'm going to be playing you pairs of tunes. I want you to tell me if they're exactly the same or slightly different.
Same. Dunno, different. Most of these are guessed.
Yeah, don't worry, you're doing fine.
Yeah, you're guessing.
You're doing good.
You're cheating.
No, you're doing your best,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, I don't know if they're the same or different, so I'll have to...
You have to have a go.
I have to have a go.
This is par for the course. Anne manages to guess only 2 out of 10 of the answers, and it's only now that she can understand the impact that this disability has had on her throughout her life.
When you, as a kid or a teenager, you went dancing, did you sense that something was wrong?
I got so many funny stories to tell about dancing is legendary. And I so much wanted to be a nice Irish dancer. And I practiced my steps every night, diligently, for 6 years. And I knew my steps, my jigs and my reels perfectly. And I could not understand why I was still in the same class 6 years later. And looking back as an adult, I think what I was dancing had no relationship to the music that was being played.
So it must have been an immense relief to find out what it was that was wrong.
Incredible, incredible. But as a teenager, none of the boys would dance with me. I used to avoid going anywhere where there was dancing, and still do, avoid situations where I have to dance because it's so socially humiliating, absolutely humiliating. I'd love to be able to do salsa. Oh, I'd love that. On to jive, but no.
Think of what you're losing by constantly refusing to dance with me. You'd be the idol of France with me. And yet you stand there and shake your foolish head dramatically while I wait here so ecstatically. You just look and say emphatically,
not this season, there's a reason. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, madam, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should do. You know what? You're lovely.
And so what? I'm lovely.
Not all what you do to me. I'm like an ocean wave that's bumped on the shore. I feel so absolutely stumped on the floor.
Ah, oh, but when you dance, you're charming and you're gentle. Especially when you do the continental.
But But this feeling isn't purely mental. For heaven rest us, I'm not asbestos. And that's why I won't dance. Why should I won't dance? How could I won't dance, merci beaucoup. I know that music leads the way to romance. And if I hold you in my arms, I won't dance.
Oh, but did he dance? Fred Astaire, of course. And he made it look so easy. He made it look like something we could all just go off and do. It is so hard, I can tell you from personal experience. My former husband, he was an actor, had to learn how to tap dance for a Broadway show that he was doing. And he was sent to do tap dancing classes. And I thought, well, I'll go with him and learn. It's the perfect opportunity. Well, he being an athlete picked it up right away. And all I could think of was, I am so, so far behind. Most basic tap step. I will never, ever be able to do anything close to what Astaire did. So I gave up. But dance is something wonderful, and it's something I've actually started to pursue in my ancient age. Going to bar classes here in Laguna Beach, the city of this radio station, KX935. Where I, Sharon James, host this radio show called The Sharon Hour. My topic tonight is the power of music and what power it has. For the man who we heard interviewing Oliver Sacks, the results of his MRI done to quantify that effect, dumbfounded his examiner.
It seems something strange was happening in my brain when I listened to the piece sung by Jesse Norman.
I mean, it's just... Your brain is just bathed in blood.
Bathed in blood, yeah.
Larry was amazed because my reaction was so extreme. My brain seemed to be bathed in blood because I'd had such an intense emotional response. By contrast, the more generic, happy and annoying music samples provoked a more typical reaction.
It's a slightly simplistic idea, isn't it? Are you happy? Are you sad?
Yeah. It's just like night and day. This is the happy and this is the angry. And it clearly shows that you had no engagement with it, except a little bit of maybe annoyance.
And the happy, I had so many potential choices, I didn't quite know how to respond to any of them.
But you had this immense emotional and whole brain reaction to the Jesse Norman. You're just basically swamped in this emotional state. It's a deep immersion of blood flow.
What Larry's experiment seems to tell us is that there's no such thing as an average brain. And there's still so much that scientists don't know about the powerful connections between music and the mind.
When Greg came into the hospital in 1977, his memory seemed to stop at about 1970. So he was then 7 years behind the times. And of course, when another 14 years passed, by the time he'd got to 91, he was 21 years behind the times. Although his ardent love for the Grateful Dead continued and he was always playing their records, singing their songs. In 91, although not exactly a deadhead myself, I met Mickey Hart, who was one of the great drummers with the Grateful Dead. I met him because we both gave testimony to Congress about the power of music, the therapeutic power of music. He invited me to come along to a Grateful Dead concert. Now, I had never been to such a thing in my life. I'm a Bach and Mozart man, but hell I, why not? I'd been invited, and in fact, I was given a seat behind the Grateful Dead on the stage, and their rhythm and the beat got to me as it got to everyone else there. And I was completely transported, and to my own amazement and the amazement of my friends, actually got up and started dancing on the stage. And I also saw how, I don't know how many people there were there, 10 or 15,000 people. Everyone was moving with the music. Everybody's dancing down the local armory with a basement full of dynamite and love artillery. Pepper chickies rising, everybody getting high.
Put on your rocket shoes, oh, Saturday night. Yeah. One more Saturday night. Oh, Saturday night.
A reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. My topic tonight is the power of music. And we've just been listening to the story, as told by famed neurologist Oliver Sacks, of a man called Greg, whose memory stopped in his youth in the 70s, around the time of his obsession with the Grateful Dead. And musically, that's where he stayed, Sacks tells us.
So then I thought, we have to get Greg to a Grateful Dead concert. Having felt the effect, even on my own sort of classical self, I was doubly determined to see the effect on Greg. And on September the 17th, 1991, we took Greg to a Grateful Dead concert at Madison Square Garden. He accompanied them with a huge voice and with enormous enthusiasm, and one would not have thought for a moment there was anything wrong with him then. He was completely with it and knew all the songs. Where the Grateful Dead did some of their later songs, Greg was very puzzled. He didn't recognize any of the songs, although he recognized their style. And he said in a mystified way, this is like the stuff the Grateful Dead might write someday. It's like the music of the future. On the way back from the concert, I kept playing CDs of the Grateful Dead to keep the mood and to sort of keep them in Greg's mind. And when I said goodbye to him, he said it'd been a wonderful evening. He'd never forget it. The next morning, I visited him and I asked him about the Grateful Dead. He said, never been to the garden.
Imagine not having any memory of the day before. You're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. My topic tonight is the power of music, and power it certainly has. But where exactly does music come from? Tony Sicuria, from whom you heard earlier, suggested that scientists, quantum physicists, feel that the brain doesn't have the capacity to store the kind of information necessary for complex musical compositions, that the brain is just a receptor for this music that comes from where? The ether? Arguably the most famous popular composer of his generation has said that this composition you're about to hear came to him fully formed in a dream. And he woke up the next morning and played it for a diverse group of people and said, does this composition already exist? Did I really dream it up myself? And they said, well, as far as they were concerned, they hadn't heard it before. And he played it for his band and he said, it's good, isn't it? I think it's mine. Well, not only was it his, but it was subsequently performed by probably the most prominent voice of his generation. You're going to hear it now, after you hear the composer's own rather tentative rendering of it early in his career.
And so, for Paul McCartney of Liverpool, opportunity knocks. Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away.
I believed in yesterday, suddenly I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came so. Such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Paul McCartney and Placido Domingo, of course, which almost concludes tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour on the Power of Music. If you want to hear this show again, it does podcast on iTunes or on our dedicated website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, Sharon. And it's hour as per the hour in time, H-O-U-R. That song, Yesterday, came to McCartney in a dream, and that's happened quite a few times that we know of. It happened to Tony Sicorio, whose story you heard earlier in this show. It happened to Sting with Every Breath You Take. He said he dreamt the line in his sleep, woke up and he had the song written in half an hour. He said he hadn't realised at the time how creepy it sounded. It sounded like he was a stalker. He'd written it in the Reagan years and he said he meant it more like Big Brother. Certainly more relevantly Big Brother these days. But it's not just fully formed musical compositions that form the stuff of dreams. It's the idea of music to many, many people. Music and the practice of it or the performance of it through playing, singing or dancing does in itself form the stuff of dreams for many of us. And I'm going to leave you with this. And hope you'll return every Monday night at 9 for more The Sharon Hours with me, Sharon James, either live here on KX935 if you live in Laguna Beach or via podcast.
Here's to the ones who dream, foolish as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that to the mess we make. She told me a bit of madness is key to give us new colors to see. Who knows where it will lead us? And that's why they need us. So bring on the rebels, the cripples from pebbles, the painters and poets and fair.